This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte, and with us we have today Lauren Cross with the Times of Northwest Indiana, who's put out some great stories in print and online. And Lauren, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, first, we should mention here that a lot of the stories deal with investigations. They're not all investigations, I know, that you cover, but that's a lot of things lately that seems to hedge your byline. And one of them in particular, it talks about some of the latest paperwork that has been filed asking for more information and records from Gary City Hall. Fill us in about this latest round of requests for information.
Yeah, so I think the subpoenas actually landed at City Hall on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Two grand jury subpoenas, federal grand jury subpoenas, and they are targeting individuals within the police department and the finance departments, which are two really interesting departments, you know, to be having subpoenas here. So I talked with the corporation counsel, Trent McCain, Tuesday night. He said he couldn't disclose any of the individuals who were being targeted, but he could say with certainty that they were within the former administration under Karen Freeman Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Freeman Wilson, she led City Hall for 8 years up until December of 2019 when Jerome Prince took over. So again, we don't know who these subpoenas are targeting, but we do know they were well before Prince took over. And I'm curious, probably as anyone else, who, you know, these are taking a look at. The interesting thing about this is that this comes after three additional subpoenas were received at City Hall since January, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we don't know the target of those, but we do know that a former confidant and city employee, Mary Cossey, was involved with those previous subpoenas. So there's a lot going on at Gary City Hall, more so than usual.
Mm-hmm.
I think Gary's no stranger to subpoenas. Of course, they had the federal indictments of two Genesis Convention Center employees for theft of funds last year. And then they had plea deals with those individuals. In state audits over the years, they've flagged misuse of money at Marquette Park and the city's finance department and the Genesis Convention Center as well, like I said. So city's no stranger to this, but it seems to be heating up.
Right. What has the Jerome Prince administration had to say about all these subpoenas, in particular the latest ones that got served earlier?
Yeah, so the Prince administration has been trying to make clear that this happened long before he entered office. And they also point out that this is a lot of the reason why they ran for public office as well against Karen Freeman Wilson in the last election. They also say that they are fully complying with anything, and they plan to fully comply with any subpoena they receive.
Mm-hmm. Any comment that you have received from any of the common council members or past council members about all this?
Well, I personally haven't reached out to them for the latest subpoena, round of subpoenas, but they have been very quiet about this indictment of Mary Cossey,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, we'll get into in a bit, but they don't want to talk about this very much, and I can certainly see why.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Mary Cossey. Who is she? What was her link to Gary City government?
Mm-hmm.
And she had several links, I know, in the time that she spent with the Gary City government before she left. And she's now working in private industry, but mm-hmm. she's still facing all of these charges. And that was an extensive story that you put in the Times about that. Let's go into detail here. Tell us about Mary Cossey and how she seems to fit into this story about the investigation into Gary City government.
Yeah. So Mary Cossey, she's a former city employee with Gary government. She's a close confidant and ally to Karen Freeman Wilson. She was Karen Freeman Wilson's director of constituent services for a couple of years during her term in office. She also served as executive director of the Gary Housing Authority. She currently works for NIPSCO as an operations manager, but she's taking a leave of absence.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this is because of a federal fraud charge that was filed against her in U.S. District Court earlier this month. She's accused of concealing more than $250,000 in income and assets as part of a bankruptcy filing.
Yep.
And that includes $187,000 deposited into a bank account owned by an individual A. So So we don't know who Individual A is, but the interesting thing is that she had this secret lending relationship with this Individual A. And Individual A let Mary Cossey run up more than $240,000 on an American Express credit card over essentially 8 to 10 year period on clothing, jewelry, what have you, Gucci handbags, a mink jacket in New York City, $5,800 from Neiman Marcus. So the interesting thing, though, about this is that, so Cossey, she defrauded her bankruptcy trustee and creditors by maintaining this secret lending relationship. And it, what the feds have got her on is that she basically paid Individual A during the term of her bankruptcy instead of treating all of her creditors equally. And that's a violation of bankruptcy law. But there's obviously something more going on here.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. If anybody that has personally or know of people that have gone through a bankruptcy proceeding, it's very complicated, and and they're very strict, very specific. Even on the pipe, even regardless of whatever type of chapter bankruptcy the person's filing for a disposal of their debts, they still have to follow the rules pretty closely. And the term, this is just one of the things that they like to watch for. And obviously, that's what has come up in the latest charges against Mary.
Yeah. So what the subpoenas show, according to the federal government, she deposited more than $250,000 into Individual A's bank account between 2013 and September 2019. And the federal agents described it as unusual and that they came from an outside or non-legitimate source. Mm-hmm. And that's where there's definitely more to this story. This appears not to be simply a bankruptcy fraud case, but it looks like feds are interested in finding out more about perhaps Individual A, or Mary Cossey, or someone else in Gary government.
I know that they're very specific in the indictment, and it goes into great detail when talks about this matter, this relationship. Certainly, and like you said, we don't know much more than what's in the court papers, to be sure, about it right now. And I'm sure it's going to have to come about not only in come up when the case comes to before the bankruptcy matter, but it's going to have to come up now in some type of, I'm sure, investigation under criminal matters.
Yeah, so all we know right now in terms of Individual A, I'm really interested in, we know she's a female, and we know that she banks at BMO Harris and Gary, and she's obviously very close to Cossey. It's also clear that the federal government is keenly interested in the fact that Cossey was paid for campaign consulting services by an unnamed political campaign in Gary and by what appears to be perhaps a sham nonprofit organization called Gary Indiana New Day Foundation. Gary New Day Foundation was registered under Mary Cossey's mother's name, Regina Cossey, and the payments to Cossey for campaign consulting came around the same time the organization was dissolved. So there's question of like how legitimate was those the consultant services. And then we also know, and not to say Karen Fumi Wilson is Individual A in the least. We have no confirmation of that.
Right.
But we do know that Karen Fumi Wilson's campaign donated to the Gary New Day Foundation in 2015. We also know that Regina Cossey, Mary's mother, was Freeman Wilson's campaign manager as recently as the last election. So there's a lot going on here. I'm curious, again, what this all means for the government's investigation into Mary, if there's something more going on.
I know one of the other questions, Lauren, that you bring up here, and it's in detail in the stories that are in print online out there in the Times concerning the bankruptcy case. You mentioned about the indictments mentioned concerning the Individual A and about the relationship, and you also mentioned too, I guess there was some question that has come up as well. It not only has come up before the bankruptcy trustee, but probably now in the federal court system. Aside from that, about how Ms. Cossey had finished up her work, I guess, with one employer, but she didn't exactly tell everybody with the bankruptcy court how she was being handled with that. Tell us a little more about this issue that she had to deal with as far as making sure she reported everything to the bankruptcy court.
Yeah. So she is accused of concealing $7,800 in severance pay for when she was working for Indian American Water. She also concealed, I think, $54,000 in retirement and investment account withdrawals, $5,000 in consulting fees, and $17,000 in rental income for her Munster property. And you really can't do that in bankruptcy court. Like you said, the rules are incredibly strict, regardless of which chapter you're filing in. And, you know, this, again, there she obviously concealed quite a lot of assets and income from the bankruptcy trustee.
Now, in sifting through all of this paperwork, Lauren, in trying to get things together before the story even made it online and in print, what kind of help did you get in helping sort things out? Did you have to consult with attorneys that are specialized more or less in bankruptcy matters to kind of understand how all this fit together?
You know, to be honest, I will say the federal government did pretty make clear like how COSI violated bankruptcy law. But, you know, I did speak with several sources that spoke with me on background.
Right.
I personally did not speak with anyone from the federal government, just to be clear, because you know how they are. They don't want to talk to anyone, even on, you know, off record. So for this case, I, you know, just kind of read through the paperwork, talked on background with people perhaps familiar with bankruptcy law, but no, I didn't talk with anyone in the federal government, absolutely.
Well, I know of one person, and your story mentions that too, that did actually go kind of on the record, although didn't say much because he doesn't know very much right now, and that's Mary Cossey's attorney, a former mayor himself and a longtime attorney in Northwest Indiana, Scott King. What did Attorney King have to say about all this representing his client?
Yeah, so King, he made some interesting comments for sure. He he's representing COSI. He made a suggestion that this is something bigger here, and perhaps this is some sort of pressure tactic by the federal government to get more out of Mary COSI. He says whether it's the former mayor or someone else being targeted, he doesn't know. But yeah, we'll hopefully see. So the federal government, they recently struck an agreement with COSI and King to extend the deadline that they can actually formally indict her. And the question is, will they indict her? Mm-hmm. They have until September 18th to do so.
And I suppose, yeah, with that deadline coming up in September, we'll know better, you know, whether it turns out to be an official formal indictment from the grand jury or whether they're going to set that aside and try and work things out, certainly in the court system, but not at least before the bankruptcy court.
Yeah, this will be interesting to see if they're still crafting a stronger case against her or if this means she's cooperating for a bigger case. We don't know. Like I said, we will hopefully find out more next month.
Now, I know, Lauren, you are often covering stories like this for The Times and doing investigative work in this respect. A lot of sifting, as you say, in this case, through the paperwork coming to you and consulting with sources to find out more, to get some answers, to get some explanation for things. And so far, of course, it's very early in the process on this particular story, but are these stories that come up often enough that you kind of say, oh, this sounds like something I did before and blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, I mean, I have covered Gary government for the last 2-3 years, and these subpoenas do happen quite frequently. You know, Gary has struggled, you know, with their tax base. They have declining population, excess values, and I know the city has an inability to operate at times, and I know the reputation doesn't help, and I know you know, misuse of funds by city employees obviously doesn't help either. So, yeah, you know, this seems like I do cover a lot of these cases, but it's just part of Gary's story at the end of the day.
That's very true, and that's part of being a newspaper reporter and a newspaper writer, to be sure.
Yeah, it's certainly an enjoyable part of my job.
Lauren Cross is a writer, reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. The latest story she has out there concerns some questions that have come up here about Gary City government and how things operate and how they've operated in the past. And Lauren, thank you very much. And we hope to have you back on again sometime soon to talk about more stories. And no doubt a lot of them will be updates on this one story, since we mentioned earlier that this matter is going to come back up in court again here sometime in September.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and let's check on stories that Carrie Napoleon's put out there in print and online in the Post-Tribune. And Carrie, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
One of the big stories that you had concerning the city of Gary follows through on a comment that I know that community activist Ruth Needleman has made before about this community benefits agreement, which has been passed by the Gary Common Council in the past. And the benefits, of course, is the idea is that if there's someone coming into the city of Gary to build something, then they should hire local help and pay them, especially if they're local people. And I know there's some review of this particular agreement that's up there, and that's what the concern is all about. Tell us what these members of the committee for the Gary CBA have to say, and what kind of reaction that Common Council has made to it.
The committee, the people from the community, it started getting together last year to create this ordinance, and they worked with Karen Freeman Wilson and kind of came up with this. And the way it's set up is if a business comes to the city and is investing money, a portion in getting a tax abatement, that's the most important part. If they're getting some type of tax abatement, they need to provide a benefit to the community, be that employing people, you know, building something specifically for the community. There's supposed to be community input to get this done. But there are challenges with the ordinance as the way it's presently written. There's no triggering mechanism, like if you spend $1 million or and get a $100,000 tax abatement a year, you have to put in X dollars.
Right.
There's nothing on there like that. So, you know, what Glorious Lay is trying to do, Councilman Lay, is tighten that up a little bit and make it more effective. And he also has concerns about the committee itself, which will be entitled to essentially tax dollars to be used for these benefits, but there's no council oversight. So his concern is that tax dollars will be spent by an entity, and these are all well-respected members of the community.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong on anything like that. These people are all very dedicated to the city of Gary, but there's still a concern that there is no elected oversight of any of these finances.
And that's
kind of where we're at.
That's what Councilman
that's
what Councilman Lay is most concerned about. He wants to be sure that there's some input somehow or another from the council, because if they have to deal with money matters, they have to approve them. Yeah. So what's come about?
And now Tuesday at the city council meeting, the mayor also had a chance to weigh in on this. And when he first took office earlier this year, he issued an executive order very early in January that deals kind of with community benefit, but it spells things out a little more directly. And it also deals not with just tax abatements, but with procurement, with supplies, with pretty much anything. And
right.
They've been working under that, the administration has, since January. And they've got some impressive totals coming out. And I'm actually working on something on that as well, as to how many minorities have been employed, how many women businesses, how many veteran-owned businesses, which is what his executive order targets.
So I understand that this measure certainly is not dead, and it's going to have more amendments, and it's going to have to come back before the Common Council for review pretty soon, I understand?
Yes, they on Tuesday they put it back to committee for further discussion, and they're trying to iron this out and see what the new committee will look like, if it will be the same people, if it will be the same members. You know, Councilman Lay would like to see any member of the committee actually submit a resume and be interviewed by the council or by the committee of the council that sees people on boards and committees. And that has not yet happened with this. So that's one of the things he's kind of hoping, and one of the things they're ironing out. You know, I do think that they will come to some type of agreement eventually on this community benefits agreement, and it is still in place. You know, they're looking at amendments on it, but the actual agreement is still active and in place the way it's currently written. It's just the way it's written, it's a little hard to enforce.
We're talking with Carrie Napoleon with the Post Tribune about the story she's put in print and online out there. Another one of the stories takes a look at the historic aspects around the town of Cedar Lake. In particular, the Historical Society is going to get some financial help, I guess, to tell a bigger and maybe even a better story.
Yeah, well, what they are doing, Julie Zazada is their executive director, and she's done a wonderful job. She's a volunteer executive director, and she has attracted a couple $100,000 total in grants to help fund this museum.
Mm-hmm.
And they have always had and told kind of the story of Cedar Lake, but the museum is undergoing a renovation that's going to make these exhibits a little more professional, a little more cohesive. And some of them are already done, so people can go and kind of get a taste of what's to come next year. You know, they're going to tell the story of Cedar Lake from the Ice Age through the ice harvesting through today.
Right.
They're doing a really nice job over there.
That's great. That's great. And what do the town council members and other people that have worked with her have to say about her work, certainly, and about the efforts to try to bring in more money to help upgrade and improve the exhibits out there?
You know, I don't know if there's been much from the county council, really, because this is, you know, just Cedar Lake.
Right.
Specifically, and it's a private, not-for-profit. But I mean, they have to be thrilled because she is doing some incredible work. She's been recognized for it. This brings her up to over $100,000 from this specific grant alone, or this specific source of grants alone. She continually is getting grants from them to do these projects and create more for the museum.
Now, let me ask you, folks that have been down to Cedar Lake, maybe, or if you live down there, you're certainly aware about the museum and what the Historical Society has done down there, but maybe people aren't aware how that building actually came about. It's in a historic building right now, which has an interesting story in itself, doesn't it?
Exactly. They actually moved that building across the lake. It was on the other side of the lake, and when the lake was frozen many, many years ago, they moved the building across the lake. It housed the workers at one point for the ice harvesting operation. And then it became a kind of resort hotel, and now it's the museum. The building itself is part of the museum. It's a very interesting story.
Now, Carrie, one of the other stories that you have out there in the Post-Tribune to check out is a story coming out of the Lake County Sheriff's Department about some new canine officers. And we know we always approve of great stories that tell us not only about these great pets, or sorry, they're working pets, we should say, but about how they do their work and are certainly a big help to the Sheriff's Department. Tell us about the latest officer, so to speak.
Oh, for sure. These two dogs will be replacing one dog who is retired and one dog who recently passed.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, the dogs are in Canada. So because of COVID,
they're not
able to get up there and do the training because of restrictions at the border. So it's going to be a little while before they get the actual officers and before our Lake County Sheriff's officers locally have the chance to go up there and train with them. But they are a great addition to the force. They help a lot in finding lost people when you have the Amber Alerts, or actually I should say the Silver Alerts for missing seniors.
Right.
They've been very helpful in finding people. They're multi-trained, so they do search and rescue along that line. They also help with narcotics investigations. They're a very valuable part of the force.
Now, this is not the first time that I guess the Sheriff's Department and the county government has turned to some Canadians to work on this project, have they?
No, they've gotten other dogs in the past from this organization. There's several around, including Lanheim in Dyer there,
right.
And they did get bids from all of them. But this happens to be the low bidder, and they did happen to work with them once in the past. So I'm not sure which of their current dogs were from this company.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there'll be a chance of the Sheriff's Department handlers that do the training of the canine dogs before they come back into Indiana. We'll have a chance to get across the border eventually into Ontario and do the training that they want to do. And Carrie Napoleon, thank you very much for spending time to talk about the stories that like this one that you put in print out there online in the Post-Tribune.
It's my pleasure. Again, thanks for having me on.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio's Regionally Speaking, we have with us Mary Freda. She's a reporter and writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and she tends to cover stories in the middle part of Lake County, in particular around Crown Point and the communities around Crown Point. And as always, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first with your story, which is big news about another big building going up in Crown Point, or at least on the edge of Crown Point. We're talking about a brand new hospital out that way. Fill us in on that, please.
Yes. So recently on Monday this week, the Plan Commission approved the first phase of this new $200 million hospital that'll be near Interstate 65 and 231 over there by the Family Express. Now, developers in the past have called this piece of land Franciscans, Pizza Pie. It's a 150-acre plot of land that will be transformed over the next 3 years, and by 2023, that new hospital will be up. Mm-hmm. Now, this first phase is just for infrastructure and a ring road at the site, but developers expect to be back before Crown Point boards in the coming months to get approval for the design of the hospital, as well as just other approvals as they are moving on.
Now, as far as you know, from what the folks at the hospital group have told you, what is this new facility in Crown Point likely to look like?
It's supposed to look similar to a hospital that was recently built in Michigan City in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
It'll really mimic that same look as that hospital, very modern. It's not going to look exactly like it, but if folks are looking to get an idea before, you know, the official design is released, they should check out the hospital in Michigan City.
Now, obviously, that's a very important corner, so to speak, of I-65 there, and particularly environmentally. What kind of plans has Franciscan Health made with their developers and the engineers in trying to plot out a location for a hospital and still keep it environmentally friendly?
Of course. So developers discussed at length during this week's Plan Commission meeting considerations for not only the environment, but as well as flooding in the area. So there will be a lot of natural grasses in the area. That landscaping is a really big deal for this project, and that was discussed a little bit during Monday's Plan Commission meeting. You know, as flooding is also a big aspect in the city, and especially in this area, and they've addressed these concerns by making sure that there's enough place for water to go in these areas, and that water will be directed in the right ways. It appears from what the developers have presented that there is quite an extensive landscape plan to maintain a more natural feel around the campus. So we'll see a lot of landscaping by the ponds that include cobblestones and different types of grass.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of indication have you gotten when you're talking with people for your story as to when they hope to be able to get some things going? We know it looks like later in the year they'll start having plans put together because they have more approvals, obviously, to get from the Crown Point City officials on this. But when do they like to do construction if they've gotten that much planned ahead?
I'm not sure that there is a set, you know, construction plan when folks might be able to see, you know, a building start to go up.
Yeah.
I know, you know, earthwork is, you know, planned for this area, and I'm not sure what much else we'll see this construction season. It's coming to a close in a couple of months, so there's not really a great answer for that yet. I think folks can expect over the next 3 years to see some changes over there, but as for when a building might come up, I'm not quite sure, and I'm not sure the developers have an answer for that either.
So it's safe to say it's going to be 2021, 22 before we may actually see some construction work out there, I suppose.
Oh, perhaps, yeah. I don't think they would have to get approvals before, you know, a building structure would begin to go up, and they have not done that as of yet for the building itself. So.
Now, I know you mentioned here in your story, and you just mentioned about the fact that there are flooding issues out there at I-65 and US 231 there in Crown Point area that they have to deal with. Flooding is a big problem in other places too, obviously, and one of them is Winfield. In fact, that's one of your stories that you had in print and online out there. Tell us about that.
So during a recent stormwater board meeting, you know, updates to various projects to address flooding were given to folks, residents in the audience, as well as board members. The city has completed culvert work along 117th Avenue, which is set to address some serious flooding that occurs when we get heavy rainfall in the region. Those culverts are said to, you know, completely eradicate flooding in that area. And officials said after last week's heavy rain, tornado-like storm, that the area was dry.
Mm-hmm.
So the culverts worked, the repair worked. So that's great to hear. And then when it comes to Hidden Creek Ditch, you know, this area residents have said and have told me has been a problem area for a very long time, two decades almost. And the city is, or rather the town, is working with the town of Merrillville and other boards to get the flooding under control. So that plan is still in progress, and changes are still being implemented. But, you know, the Stormwater Board seems to be very optimistic about the changes that are coming for that area.
I know you mentioned in your story about some of the residents who live out there in Hidden Creek Estates. They've complained for a long, long time. They say that, that some of the residents out there don't seem to help matters either. They like to dump stuff out there, don't they?
Yes, yes. One of the residents I chatted with said, you know, there's a creek that runs between some of the homes that often becomes cluttered with grass clippings or other items, and you know, he said to me he's often out there cleaning it up himself just to try and help the flooding not become so excessive. So it's definitely an issue out there.
We're talking with Mary Freda of The Times on the stories that she has written and put in print and online out there recently. And one of the other stories, too, talks about the Crown Point Community Foundation. They do regular grant issuance, and I guess they've turned out another grant cycle. Tell us about the process and about some of the big grants that went out this time around.
So the Crown Point Community Foundation has three grant cycles every year. This most recent grant cycle was its June 1st grant cycle, the second one of the year, and the awards were announced this week, and there were 14 recipients. Some of the biggest recipients we've seen this round of grants is the Pink Ribbon Society, which won $10,000 to maintain its current programs. That's really important because this week the Pink Ribbon Society also issued a call out to its members and members of the community to say, we need your help.
Yeah.
So they've also, you know, put out a call, an SOS, they've called it, Save Our Society, asking folks to help support their mission. So they got $10,000 from the Crown Point Community Foundation this week, but their organizers told me, you know, they need about $80,000 to have a fully 100% funded Pink Ribbon Society. So that's just a chunk of their operating fund every year. Meals on Wheels of NWI also got a big grant, $7,000, to help provide and deliver meals to folks around the region, especially low-income seniors. And then the Crown Point School, the Crown Point Community School Corporation also got $6,000 for its students to what they've said is boost and broaden educational opportunities. So lots of big grants this time around.
Yeah. One of the ones of note, too, I know you have in the story, talks about Habitat for Humanity, which is always looking to find the funding so they can help build more houses, for which, of course, set up the sweat equity concept here in Northwest Indiana, people helping build their own houses. And people that don't have a home and maybe have never had a home before actually get an opportunity to take a home, a first-time home ownership here. And I know that the foundation put out some money for Habitat for Humanity this time, didn't they?
Yes, they did. The Habitat of Humanity received $5,000, and that funding will help purchase flooring for a home being built in Lowell. So, yep.
Quite a few that come up on cycle here, I know. From what you found out from the information that the foundation sends on, you mentioned that they do the cycle of grants three times a year. They have more. In fact, they have another final grant, I guess, cycle coming up here. The deadline's coming up pretty soon, isn't it?
Yes, the last grant cycle of the year opened on July 1st, and its deadline is September 1st. So folks who are looking for some funding for South Lake County projects should check out the Crown Point Community Foundation. They have a lot of good things listed on their website about what to check out if you're considering to apply. Now, organizations can only apply for funding once a year, so that's something to consider. But there's more information on the Community Foundation's website if folks are looking for specifics on how to apply for a grant for the last cycle of 2020.
Mary Freda is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and thank you very much, Mary, for bringing us up to date on the stories that you put out there for everybody to check out. And we'll be back with you again soon, I hope.
Thank you so much for having me again, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for listening. And our thanks to our contributors for the program today, to Times North Lake County reporter Lauren Cross, to Times South Lake County reporter Mary Freda, and to Post Tribune freelance reporter Carrie Napoleon for the stories that they put out in print online and telling us about. We have another Regionally Speaking coming up for you on Monday. Hope you'll join us for that.